Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. I hope you had a nice week and the one that's starting today will be even better. If you have a good book to read, you're halfway there. If you don't have a good book, I can recommend the one we'll be talking about this morning, The Fourth Law by Paul Stein. It's an action thriller with a human twist and I couldn't put it down. We'll get to Paul and his book in just a bit. But first, if you've never heard the show before, let me introduce myself. I'm Linda Field, the host of Manzanita Voices, and you'll find me here each week at this time. Our listening audience has really grown, by the way. The show originates in Jackson, California, about an hour's drive from Sacramento, but we've been joined by a Western New York station, WGWE-FM in Salamanca, New York. Salamanca happens to be my hometown. I went to high school there, and my other hometown is Ellicottville, about 12 miles away. That's where I went to grade school, and my dad had a Western Auto store. We're so happy to have Western New York with us today, and I'd love to hear from you. I'll tell you how to contact me shortly. This program is about writers and their books, and if you love the written word, then you've found a good spot. Get comfortable and pour another cup of coffee, and we'll get right to it. We'll start with a new feature called the Morning Workout. I want to get all the writers who are listening to take part in this show, so every week I'll read one of your poems or short fiction at this time. Since this is a morning show, let's see if we can get pieces from you that are about the beginning of the day. They should be up to about 2 minutes long. They should be original, but it's okay if you've had them published already. Just let me know where they've appeared so I can give credit. Your work can be funny, serious, affectionate, or grumpy. Write about the beautiful sunrise you saw, or a butterfly that landed on the rosebud outside your bedroom window. How about the dog that barked all night, and now you're bouncing off the walls because you didn't get enough sleep? Maybe you have some nice thoughts about how nice it is to wake up next to the one you love. But don't get too graphic, because I don't want my grandmother to blush. Do you get the idea? Great. Embed your poem or short fiction in an email to me at writers@kvgcradio.com. Think Voice of the Gold Country, kvgc.com. Remember, please embed your work. I'd rather not have to open any attachments. It's safer that way. Again, that website or that email address is writers@kvgcradio.com. The morning workout piece for today is a poem by Monica Rose, founder of Manzanita. It appears on page 134 of her book, River by the Glass, that came out just a few months ago. It's called The Ritual of Coffee Making. A light place in the sun opens doors on cubic floors. A trickling of water announces the morning of coffee coming into our world. Your hands measure endless spoons of burnt sienna granules. The carafe waiting patiently for the burst of ah. You pour the fall right into my cup, cascading, filling the deep yawning cavern. Then our words burst. Slippered and robed, we rub each other's sleep from eyelashes, laughing at how crusty we have become. Trusting that the machine will not break down, not this morning. You vary vanilla and creme brulee. Taste it, you say. Is it okay? My lips purse and sip at the mug with a small taste of edge to say, this will be a brimming day. Monica Rose from River by the Glass. May all of us have a brimming day today. Do you get the idea? Send in your entry, a poem or short fiction. Tell us something about your morning. Maybe some of you are needing some motivation to get writing. Well, here it is. We want to hear your work on the radio. Remember, embed your work in an email to me at writers@kvgcradio.com. Well now, Paul Stein has been patiently waiting for us, and I'm eager to talk with him about his book, The Fourth Law. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning. Good morning, Linda. Good morning, all readers and writers all over the Motherlode and Hometown Radio, and my gosh, all the way to New York.
That's right.
How exciting. Yeah.
That's right. It is exciting. No kidding. I could not put your book down. It's a real page turner.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Music to my ears.
It kept me up too late a lot of nights. It's an action thriller, but it also has an interesting human component. I was really interested in the forgiveness and redemption aspects of the story. Let's see. There are these two cousins, Ryan Marshall and Jared Conrad.
Right, right.
They hate each other.
Yep. Yep. Full of animosity all the way through.
From childhood on.
Yep.
Ryan, they're both really talented guys, and I think quite brilliant in their
exactly.
own ways.
Yep.
And they're both trying to levitate things.
That's
they're
right.
Both trying to
they
lift.
They have a common goal. Yep.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. So they have a lot of things in common, even though they don't like each other. Ryan is the owner of a company called Levitation Solutions. It's a multinational corporation, and he's a genius at his job where he uses high steel cranes to build impossible structures. In the story, he's directing the construction of a bridge high over the River Rio Grande Gorge.
In Taos, New Mexico. Great place. If you've never been there, go see it. Yeah.
I've never been there. Oh, it sounds beautiful. Now, Jared Conrad, his cousin, is even more of a genius. He's a scientist at Stanford University, and he has figured out how to build a machine that will defy gravity. This machine and what it can do are at the core of the plot, along with the way these two guys hate each other.
That's exactly right. You've got it. That is the essence of the story, The Fourth Law.
Okay. Then enter the evil Alistair Holloway. What a name. That's a good name.
Yeah, he's a lot of fun. Yeah.
He is. And he brings a lot to the story. He's a mega wealthy tycoon, and he wants to steal the anti-gravity device to rob Fort Knox. Doesn't he already have enough money?
Never has enough money. Ask any billionaire.
That's the truth. We all know that. He's aware of the hatred that these two cousins have for each other, and he thinks of a way to use it against them. How am I doing?
Very good. Very good. You've got the essence perfectly. Basically, it's about a guy that invents an anti-gravity machine. It's stolen by an evil mastermind, all bent with the single-minded intention of robbing Fort Knox of $1 billion in gold. That's it. That's the story of The Fourth Law.
Have you ever been to Fort Knox?
I've never been to Fort Knox, but I did a lot of research on the Internet and know quite a bit about it.
Oh, so, my goodness.
No, you don't get to visit Fort Knox anymore. It is one of the closely and most highly prized and guarded places in the United States.
Oh, my goodness. Well, You seem to know about it so much in the book, I wondered if you ever tried to rob it yourself.
Yeah, it's a little bit like Tom Clancy. You can research anything on the Internet.
The Internet. Oh, boy, oh, boy. You're listening to Manzanita Voices, and we're talking with Paul Stein about his book, The Fourth Law. Paul, you have a degree in biology from the University of San Francisco.
That's correct.
And you certainly have a lot of scientific and medical knowledge beyond biology. You know a lot about physics, for instance. The fourth law of the universe is gravity.
That's correct.
What are the other three?
Okay, you said something a little bit provocative, because when you study biology and the life sciences, basically, you study chemistry, you study physics, you study all the earth sciences to get that degree.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I did while I was studying physics in conjunction with getting my degree was to learn about the four fundamental laws that guide and basically direct the universe. So the fourth law is gravity. The first one, though, is the strong nuclear force. The second one is the weak nuclear force. The third one is the electromagnetic force. And the fourth one is gravity. So there are really four fundamental forces that guide and direct the entire flow of energy through the universe, the fourth one being gravity.
And that's what keeps all the planets in place.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, gravity is the most elusive and little known of all the forces. Electromagnetic, we obviously know because we have electricity. Strong and weak nuclear forces are what were used by Einstein to create nuclear energy and nuclear bombs and things like that. So it's all fundamentally interrelated, but gravity just kind of hangs out there, and we don't really know that much about it. It is still elusive to this day. It's never been figured out.
Hmm.
That's although we know it exists. we know that it keeps the moon connected to the Earth. It keeps the Earth connected to the sun.
Uh-huh.
It keeps the sun connected to the Milky Way galaxy. So everything is interrelated, and gravity is the glue that keeps it all together. So it's just a profound and extremely prevailing force.
That's right. And it's the one that we really are the most familiar with, because anytime you drop your fork or you fall down the stairs, you're very much aware of gravity.
Think Newton. He dropped that apple, and it always goes to the ground. Yeah,
that's right.
Or some would say the Earth rushes up to catch it. You know, that's a different way of looking at it.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I know that this is a science fiction plot, but could your idea for the anti-gravity device actually work? It sounds plausible to me.
You know, I really think it could, and there have been a couple of people that have suggested that I send, my book to somebody at MIT or to, the Stanford Research Institute or somebody like that that would take a look at how I've combined the nuclear energy that is available to us through uranium and plutonium and put it into a format like you're creating, an electric motor. That's exactly how we create electrons. That's exactly how we create electricity. So by changing and basically manipulating exactly how you use the nuclear part with the magnetic part, I'm thinking that maybe you could make a graviton which would defy gravity. So will it work? I don't really know, but it sounds provocative, and it possibly could. So who knows? I haven't actually sent it to MIT yet, but you keep asking me, and other people keep asking me, maybe I should.
I think you should. Yeah. I really do think you should. You mentioned gravitrons. Did I say it right?
Gravitrons, yeah. That's just
did
a name I made. Yeah,
term?
I just made that up. Yeah.
Like nuclear.
Electron,
proton, neutron,
uh-huh.
and gravitron.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the gravity essence, the essence of gravity is so elusive, we don't know what it is. Einstein was able to figure out that there are protons and neutrons. That's how he split those to make the first atomic bomb, or he came up with the theory to create the first atomic bomb. It was actually Robert Oppenheimer that made the first bomb in Los Alamos. But what they were doing is splitting atoms, and they were splitting subatomic particles of atoms, and they spun these things out, and they called them protons, neutrons, electrons, pisons, all these other things. So I'm thinking, well, if we're talking gravity, it must be a gravitron. So that's what I came up with.
I agree. Must be. Well, folks, if you're listening and you're just becoming so energized by all of this talk of science, there's a lot more to the book. So stay tuned. We've got to take a break right now. But we'll be back, and we'll talk about some other aspects of this very entertaining novel. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. Remember to email me with your comments at writers@kvgcradio.com. You can also check the Manzanita Press website at www.manzapress.com. That's manzapress.com to learn what our nonprofit press is doing these days. We're talking today with science fiction thriller writer Paul Stein, author of The Fourth Law.
Good morning again.
So, okay, the book opens. It's a dark, moonless night, and these ninja guys dressed in black parachute onto the rooftop of a science lab at Stanford University. There's a lot of high-tech security, but these guys are pros, so no sweat. They know their job. Think of the Navy SEALs, and you've got them pegged. What are they after?
Okay, well, you mentioned earlier to our listeners that Jared Conrad invented this anti-gravity machine, and so he works for the Stanford Research Institute. He's a professor at Stanford. He's a professor at physics. And these guys have basically parachuted onto the Quantum Building, which is a building in Stanford. They're going to rappel down the side of the building, break into Jared's office, and steal the computer files and all of the information on this anti-gravity machine. So that's what they're doing. They're trying to penetrate the building, and of course they're being paid. These are highly skilled mercenaries. They're being paid by Alistair Halloway, the bad guy, to steal this equipment from Jared Conrad. You know, so that's what they're after. That's how the book starts. They jump out of the plane. They parachute onto the roof. It's at night. They rappel down the side of the building. They break into the building. They steal the stuff, and then they get out. And that's the beginning of the book.
Sounds like the opening of a good movie.
I hope so. I'm trying to get Hollywood interested in this thing. I think it'd be a good movie, too.
I would think so.
So many people have told me that.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
So, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, because we have somebody being blown up by a bomb. We have kidnapping. We have murder and mayhem. And
mm-hmm.
we've got a family in crisis and with a lot of anger involved. And there's got to be some forgiveness eventually somewhere in there.
We'd hope so.
It's a good story. So, the evil Alistair Holloway has put this plan in motion, and he sends the police after Ryan Marshall and draws Marshall's ex-wife Sarah into the plot. Pretty soon, their son Jeremiah is involved, too, and that wasn't really in the plan, but there are bad feelings everywhere. Sarah's bitter about the way the marriage ended, and Jeremiah has been estranged from his father since his parents split up. This is pretty typical of what happens in a divorce, but soon these people are thrown together with a hated cousin, Jared Conrad. With all the bad karma flying around, that's not all. Did I mention that there's a gorgeous Angelina Navarro, the paid companion of Alistair Holloway, who floats around on his yacht with him? And how about Dr. Stella Coscarelli, who's in love with Jared Conrad? She's a scientist working on a cure for muscular dystrophy. You have really come up with a plot.
Yeah, I've got a lot of moving parts in this story, as they say. That's right.
Is there something that you'd like to read from the book to give the listeners a taste of what's happening?
Well, let me see if I can select something. You mentioned Sarah and Ryan and the animosity that they have towards Jared Conrad. So let me just kind of set this up. I've got about a page here that I can read that speaks to this a little bit better. But
okay, Sarah and Ryan are the divorced couple.
Sarah and Ryan are the divorced couple. Ryan is one of the cousins that hates Jared, and they've come together now because Alistair Holloway has figured out to make it look like Ryan actually stole the equations from Jared's office. So we know that the mercenaries went in and they did this theft. But what Alistair has done, he's so conniving and so manipulative that he has made it look like Ryan actually did the theft so that it puts the police on the wrong trail. So now Ryan is out there on his own trying to come up with a way to clear his name, and this is a conversation that he has with Sarah, his wife, for the first time when she finds out what's going on. So let me read here, and I hope that I can see over these glasses and this microphone. I'm going to turn it sideways a little bit, and we'll continue. Okay, so starts off. Thankfully, the phone interrupted her recollection. "This better be you, Ryan," she said, answering the phone. "Well, your intuition is correct, Sarah," Ryan replied, sensing there was going to be an argument. "I'm really sorry to bother you." "Oh, really, Ryan? Don't you dare patronize me. Where are you?" she demanded. "Do you realize the trouble you've caused? How can you be so selfish?" "You have every right to be angry," Ryan started. "I can't tell you where I am. But if you'll give me a few minutes to explain, I think you'll understand." "I'm listening, but make it quick. Detective Westbrook is on his way over." "That's exactly why I called, Sarah. Corky tells me he explained what happened up at the gorge. Listen, we both know that Jared's capable of anything. I can't let them arrest me for something I didn't do, something else Jared was obviously set up. You of all people should understand to what length he'll go to hurt me, to hurt us. This is another one of his elaborate schemes, Sarah. He's taken away my family, and now he wants to strip me of my freedom. I will not be drawn into his web." "Jared is right, Ryan. You are a moron," she bellowed, knowing that her words would land a terrible blow. "Don't you see he is drawing you into his web? You're such a fool. How could you fall for another one of his fiendish tricks?" "Sarah, listen to me," Ryan shot back. "I don't expect you to understand why I have to find Jared. It's between him and me. But please, don't underestimate him for a second. He vandalized our crane, Sarah. I know it as surely as I believe in God. It could have killed a bunch of our guys. And if that weren't enough, he's accused me of breaking into his lab. Please, this has all the earmarks of his handiwork. Come on, you know it's the truth." There was a pause. Sarah listened for a moment until she was sure he was through. "Honestly, Ryan, I don't think the two events have anything to do with one another. You have such a rational hatred for Jared that you see boogeymen behind every shadow and imagine he has something to do with it. You need help. Please turn yourself in before someone gets hurt. Think about what you're doing. Jail lies at the end of this path," she pleaded. Sarah, I have no intention of turning myself in. I don't trust Jared, but I do respect his intelligence. He's planted evidence proving I was in his office. If they catch me before I can prove my innocence, I'm history. My only chance is to get to him before the police catch me. He's never been able to hide what he's up to, and that's part of the sick pleasure he gets from hurting me. He'll give it up, I promise you. So what if he doesn't? Sarah asked, bewildered. Are you going to beat him up too, just like the old days? That's unfair, Sarah. I was hoping we could be civil. Ryan replied, hurt that she still thought so little of his character. I haven't figured out what I'm going to do, but I promise I won't get physical. Give me a little credit, will you? She didn't answer. Whatever happens, when I catch up with Jared, I need you to consider what you tell Westbrook, he continued. Please try to understand my point of view, Sarah. I'm not asking you to lie. Just don't give him any more than necessary. Can you do that for me? Sarah drew a deep breath and exhaled slowly. Ryan, I'm so tired of the endless drama between you and Jared. I don't have the energy for this any longer. Just tell me what you want me to do, she said wearily. Tell the detective exactly what Corky told you, nothing more. Don't embellish anything. If he asks why I would resist arrest and where I might be headed, simply tell him we've been divorced for 5 years and you no longer understand my thinking. But whatever you tell him, please don't let on that we spoke today, okay? Oh, right. Don't lie, just fudge the truth. How should I answer when he asks whether I've had any contact with you? How should I answer when he asks if I can think of any reason why you might run? What you're asking is not to reveal your hatred for Jared. Isn't that the real truth, Ryan? Sarah, you're right, as usual. You always know me better than I know myself. Most times you know what I'm planning before I did. That's a touchstone in our relationship that will never change, he said affectionately. Ryan knew it was unfair to expect Sarah to do anything but tell the truth. It was not in her nature to do otherwise. He never felt so totally alone in all of his life. Hellfire, he said. Tell the detective everything. That Jared and I had a rocky history. That he was the cause of our divorce. That you spoke to me this morning. That you believe I'm on my way to California to confront him. Tell him the whole truth, Sarah. Then please, pray that I somehow survive this. I love you, Sarah. Thanks for helping me think this through. Goodbye, he said abruptly, ending the call.
And he does love Sarah.
Oh, he does, very much.
Very much. And
very
she
much.
Loves him, too.
Very
and
much.
But those two sound like a typical situation where two people really love each other deeply, but something has come between them.
Something has come between them, and we can only see what's going to happen. You got to read the book. Are they going to get back together? Will they work together? Yeah.
That's
so it's,
right.
It's some fun stuff.
Yeah. Now, Jared and Ryan, their animosity goes back to childhood because their mothers pitted them against each other.
Mm-hmm.
The mothers were sisters who were very competitive.
Right.
And they
twin sisters.
Twins. I forgot
mm-hmm.
that. Yes,
mm-hmm.
twin sisters. And they pitted their sons against each other in competition after competition and kind of created this rivalry.
No, they did. They yeah. absolutely did. They have this intense rivalry amongst themselves. And so once they finally had their oldest children born, they wanted to make that sense of rivalry personified into their offspring, into their firstborn young men. So that's how it happens. The mothers actually forced these kids together, and they butted heads so often that they began to hate one another, and the rivalry is born and off and running.
Well, that's too bad. They might have been friends if that hadn't happened.
Yeah, it could have been. You never know. But
yeah.
Blood is thicker than water, so we'll see.
That's right. We'll see. Ryan has also done something that when he did this in the book, I was so surprised. You've got a lot of twists and turns in this novel. And when the character does something that I would never do, I just say, oh, no, don't do that. And he actually kind of has the police officer who comes to arrest him. He has the police officer, in effect, kidnapped by his own employees just for a while, just for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hold somebody against their will, isn't that kidnapping?
Oh, well, it's I don't know if it's kidnapping, but it's certainly obstructing justice. And so when Detective Westbrook, and that's who I alluded to in what I just read, he shows up at the Rio Grande Gorge where they're building the span to basically bring Ryan in. Ryan senses right away, wait a second, I knew my crane was vandalized. I just figured that out. Something is amiss. Now I've got this the sheriff coming, this police officer, detective, coming to arrest me.
For a crime that I supposedly committed in California.
Yeah, exactly. And then I find out that it's Jared Conrad that I'm supposed to have broken into his office. He just goes off the wall.
Ballistic.
He's just absolutely incensed by this. So, and then you got to understand, he's got a group of very unruly construction workers all around him. So when they find out that their boss is basically going to be accosted or arrested against his will, they just say, okay, bring it on, buddy. You're alone against about 15 or 20 of these steel workers. You can't get to us. So they do. They obstruct justice. Ryan gets away, and he's off and running.
Oh, my gosh. There's a recipe for trouble.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be back in just a few moments to talk again with Paul about more of the book. This is Manzanita Voices. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. I'm your host, Linda Field, and I'd like to welcome those of you who are just joining us. Our show is for everybody who loves books, and if you want to find out more about the people who write them, you've come to the right place. I also want to say a special hello to Western New York listeners at WGWE Radio FM in Salamanca. Earlier in the show, I introduced a new part of the show called Morning Workout, and I do want to make sure that everybody's aware of that, because if you are a writer and you'd like to have something that you've created read on the air, this is your chance. I want to read your material. Because this is a morning show, I'm looking for pieces that are about 2 minutes long that have something to do with morning. It might be burning the coffee or burning the toast in the morning or making coffee or oversleeping or taking a beautiful walk at sunrise. Anything that's, it can be poetry, it can be short fiction, but I want to be sure to get your writing on the air. So please send in some entries for me and you may hear your work. Paul Stein, we're getting back to you now.
And good morning again.
Yes, good morning. Now, we're talking about The Fourth Law, which is an action thriller. But the human component that runs through this is not just the animosity and the anger that the two cousins feel for each other, but Ryan and Sarah Marshall, the divorced couple, they have a son named Jeremiah. But Jeremiah had a twin named Jacob who died way too young. And I noticed that in your book, you dedicate this book to your two sons. And you say, to Galen, whom you still miss, and Jason, whom you love. So Galen died too young also.
Mm-hmm.
Did you write the part of Jacob in the book for your son, Galen?
Well, yes, I did, and thank you for asking about that. And it's I hope I can get through it without tearing up, you know. So we'll see how good my internal constitution is. But yes, Galen and Jason are my two twin boys. Galen Stein was born with muscular dystrophy, and he died at the tender age of 16 while he was a sophomore in high school. And so he's always been sort of my mentor, my spiritual guide, my my warrior. He was the most courageous person I've ever met. So I dedicated the book to him and his son, who still lives at the ranch with me. He's a contractor, Jason. I'm very proud of him. But the part in the book about Jacob, who was one of the twins that had muscular dystrophy and died, is actually a mirror of what happened to my life. My wife and I had the twin boys, and Galen died of muscular dystrophy, and so I write a little bit about that. It's not really, you know, meant to be a memoir of any sorts, but it does present the conflict that Ryan has deep in his heart, deep in his soul, of having that sense of loss, and he's always trying to do better with his life, to overcome that sense of grief and sadness that he felt from losing his son, and that's very much shown in the story throughout.
Yes, it is, and I can tell that he has become a very spiritual person, and therefore, since you created this character, you must also be a very spiritual person. Did you always see life this way, or did it develop as you and your family went through Galen's illness and death?
Well, I've always been a believer. I mean, I am a Christian, and so I do very much believe in a higher power. And, you know, so it's something that's evolved, though. When you go through something like that, Linda, when you lose a child, you are tested in ways that you never thought would be possible, and you gain resolve and you gain strength and courage by coming through that kind of a process. And that's why I allude to many times a saying in that book called, you know, the strongest steel passes through the hottest fire. And when you're battle tested, when you're hardened by fire and adversity and basically just the travails and setbacks of life, you end up becoming stronger and more resolute and more passionate about living each day. And so I would say that, yes, it has definitely shaped me. Did I always think like that? Probably not. I could never have gotten to the point that I am now having not gone through that.
Mm-hmm.
But since I have, I do feel that it was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Yes. Yeah, I can see that. And the saying, the hardest steel passes through the hottest fire, definitely seems to express what has happened with you. There's another saying, when God closes a door, he opens a window.
That's correct. Yeah, it's kind of the same thing. You know, it's almost, you know, glove in hand there. Those are very common sayings that fit very well in this case.
Yes, for sure. Do you have any advice for people who are going through what your family experienced?
Well, you know, yes. I mean, there's a lot of things. There's a whole range of topics that I could talk about from that standpoint, Linda. But I would say that basically the most important thing is to treasure each day. Live each day literally like there is no tomorrow, because in this particular case, or when you have, you know, when you're working with or living with a terminal, you know, patient, no matter if it's a son, a wife, or whoever it is, I mean, you can't take for granted that tomorrow is going to come.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't know that. But in some regards, that also makes living so much more richer, because each day is now a special day. And we did so many wonderful things with Galen when he was alive. I mean, we got to meet Joe Montana and Jerry Rice. He became an honorary captain of the San Francisco 49ers. We went to the Giants games and sat in the dugout and met Will Clark. And I mean, it was just a wonderful experience. We went to Disneyland, and when you take a handicapped kid to Disneyland, you don't have to stand in lines.
Wow.
They let you come in the exit. I mean, so the world just unfolds in such a unique way when you have a handicapped child, that if you keep your eyes open to the love and the things that are coming through you and to you because of that experience, it is so enriching. It's just absolutely empowering. So the tough part, though, is to get to the loss once you actually have the loss. And you have to be willing to reach out to people. Don't isolate. Make sure that you stay connected to the community. Reach out to help groups. And then get involved with something else. You can get involved, in this case, with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, which we did for a while. And it can be, like I said, a very empowering, very enriching experience. But quite frankly, I don't wish that experience on anyone. It's something that you never want to outlive your children. It's not a good thing.
I'm sure it's just the most awful thing. But that's good advice. Don't isolate yourself,
don't
take any day for granted.
Yep.
Just live it to the
fullest.
That's
the best advice that I could give to anyone, really, on everything. I mean, don't take anything for granted. You don't know about tomorrow.
That's true.
All we have is today.
That is the truth. Now, you have something I think you'd like to read that kind of deals with the son.
Yeah, let me just read something towards the end of the book, and I'm going to move my microphone around here a little bit. Hopefully Becca can still pick it up and hear me all right. This is basically towards the end of the book, and Ryan, again, is feeling very, very disconsolate. He's very upset that he feels like he's let Jared down. They're both on this quest. By this point in the book, they've figured out that they've been duped, that this Alistair Holloway, who they don't really know his name, but they know that there's somebody out there orchestrating this madness that has caught themselves in this horrible web. And so Ryan is coming from two different directions. Ryan is coming to Fort Knox to try to help and rescue Jared. Jared is basically at Fort Knox, and Ryan is just at his wit's end. He feels like he's failed again, and this is one of the last pages in the book where he's remembering Galen, remembering Jacob, And this is how it's written. So
just one second here. We have Ryan, the cousin who used to hate his cousin Jared,
mm-hmm.
now going to his rescue.
Oh, absolutely. So that's the conflict in the book. They hated each other.
So much.
But blood, like I said, is thicker than water. Once they figured out that they'd been set up, once they figured out that you said there was a couple of kidnappings, Jerry is kidnapped, they don't know where he is. So these guys had to come together and set aside all this animosity and set aside this ill will and bad feelings and come together as a family and work through this process together. It forced them together and forced them to come together. So,
there's a big lesson there,
There's a huge character arc.
Forgiveness
there. Yeah. Can
and
you
redemption.
Overcome and can you forgive and will you be redeemed? That's exactly
right.
Correct. Good comments. Thank you, Linda. Okay, so I'm going to read this. We'll see where we go here. Ryan looked at the sky ahead, ablaze with lights and sirens. He could make out the trailer and noted for the first time that the navigator had made a direct hit. He remembered bullets hitting the windshield before he set the cruise control and aimed the car in the direction of the trailer just before bailing out. He was amazed it actually worked, but had no idea if he'd helped Jared in the slightest. He was disconsolate. A feeling of failure blasted through his consciousness. It reminded him of Jacob. Not again. Please, not again. Just as I'd failed Jacob, so too have I failed Jared. He remembered the day that Jacob had died. Ryan had slept on the floor beside his bed the night before, his son's labored breathing more tortured than ever. He couldn't bear the thought of Jacob dying alone. He still remembered their last conversation. "Dad," Jacob asked, "what happens when you die?" Ryan had searched his soul for the right words to answer his son's profound question. Clearly, Jacob was scared, but faced his fear with the courage of a lion. "I don't know for sure, son," he answered, "but I do know that you don't have to worry about anything. You've been a good boy, and you'll go straight to heaven. You'll fall peacefully asleep, and your spirit will rise from your body, and you'll be whisked to heaven by a legion of angels welcoming you home. You'll be able to fly, Jacob, and that old muscular dystrophy will never again keep you from doing anything your heart desires. What about you and Mom? Will I ever see you again?" "Of course you will, son. Your mom and I love you more than life itself. You'll go ahead and prepare the way. Just you wait. We'll all be together in heaven one day soon. Your brother Jerry, too." Jacob had survived the night, but Ryan could tell from his pale blue complexion the next morning that the end was near. God was merciful in the end. Jacob's death came swiftly, and Ryan wasn't present when he began to choke. Unable to catch his breath, he quickly asphyxiated, slumping forward in his wheelchair. Had Ryan been present, the impulse to start CPR would have been irresistible. When the paramedics did arrive, it was too late. Their efforts to revive him were all for naught. Jacob died with his little dog Minnie on his lap, a loyal friend to the very end. The haunting despair of this memory and the powerlessness he had felt following Jacob's death came storming back. Once again, he felt an inconsolable emptiness, as if his soul was mortally wounded and the stabbing pain in his heart would never heal. All his efforts seemed hopelessly inadequate. Ryan hung his head in shame, putting his hands to his face, and he began to weep. "Why does this keep happening? What do you want from me, God? Help me, Lord," he called out, throwing his hands to the heavens in surrender, coming to terms with the abject helplessness and despair he felt. Jared's voice rushed him back to reality. "Ryan! Ryan, where are you, man?" "I'm here," Ryan called back, straining, but his voice was barely more than a whisper. He tried to stand again, but the pain was too great. He remained on his knees, not even sure if he could lie down. "Jared," he called again, with the last ounce of energy he could summon. His body began to tremble at the realization that Jared was still alive.
Paul Stein, The Fourth Law. We'll be back in just a few moments. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, your host, and we're talking today with Paul Stein.
Glad to be here.
Paul, before we talk any more about your writing, you have such an interesting past and current life. We ought to let our listeners in on some of this. You were the head of the California Department of Fish and Game.
Well, I was the chief deputy director of the Department of Fish and Game, so that's the number two position, basically, in the hierarchy of Fish and Game. But, yeah, I served in Governor Schwarzenegger's first term, his first 3 years because of the recall campaign. But, was involved with the Department of Fish and Game. It was a fun run.
And before that, you were a county supervisor?
Well, I've lived in Calaveras County since 1975, and so I ran a rainbow trout fish hatchery, developed and ran a rainbow trout fish hatchery there for many years, over 20 years.
Where is that hatchery?
It's on the Middle Fork of the McCallumee River outside of West Point, just across the border here. So the North Fork of the McCallumee basically bisects Amador and Calaveras County, so I'm just about 20 miles from here and ran a business for many years. And that's how I got involved with Fish and Game and the hierarchy of the state regulatory agency. So, then I became a supervisor. I was elected to two terms as a county supervisor and served the West Point District 2 area of Mountain Ranch, Glencoe, Railroad Flat, Wilseyville, all the way to Sheep Ranch. It was great.
Those people back in New York State. Listen to all these names again. Go through some of those names.
Yeah, I represented Mountain Ranch, West Point, Glencoe, Wilseyville, Sheep Ranch, Railroad Flat, Paloma. So I had the biggest district because of the sparse population. It's very rural, and we don't have a lot of people living out there, but they're all good folks, So it's the best district to represent in Calaveras County, in my opinion. Of course, I'm biased. I would be. But, when I was a supervisor, I got to work with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I was one of his surrogate speakers during the recall campaign because I was president of the State Association of Counties, and that's what launched me basically into the state capitol once Arnold won his first term because I was on his team. He wanted to know what job I wanted, and I said, I want to be in charge of Fish and Game. He says, well, I can't make you in charge of it, but I'll make you number two. And I said, I'll take it.
You'll take it.
That's how that all came about.
Oh, my gosh. Well, now you have a ranch. You're pretty much retired.
I am retired to be a full-time author, so I'm never going to be retired. I'm always going to be working on something. But, yeah, I've owned the ranch since about 1975, and live right there on the Middle Fork of the McCallumee River, and it's a gorgeous spot, and that's where I do my writing and my thinking, all my creativity comes right from that spot.
Oh, my gosh. Do you have lots of animals on the ranch?
We used to have everything, right down to a milk cow. I mean, we had pigs and sheep and goats, but I always told people I had more animals than anybody in the county, and they said, oh, no, you couldn't have more than Garamendi's cows, and I said, well, at about 150,000 fish at one time, and last time I looked, those were animals. Nobody can beat that.
No, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Tell me, this is a little bit off the path, but last night I had a delicious ear of corn, and I thought about as I was cleaning the corn again. I was, complaining to myself about the corn silk because it's so hard to get rid of when you're getting an ear of corn ready to cook. But somebody told me a long time ago that I had said something like, wouldn't it be great if we could get rid of the corn silk and just be able to clean corn that much easier? And whoever it was said, oh, you wouldn't want to do that. You wouldn't have any corn. Now, you're a biologist, but I bet you know the answer to this. Is corn silk really important to corn?
It absolutely is. It's vital to the corn. I mean, if you don't have the corn silk, they don't. Each of those little kernels of corn doesn't get pollinated. It can be pollinated by bees or by wind, but the actual fertilization process is following down each of those corn silks, and each of those corn silks is attached to one kernel of corn. So if you don't have the corn silks, you're not going to be eating corn.
Oh my gosh.
Whoever told you that was absolutely
correct.
That
is true. Well, I'm glad that something I remembered was accurate.
So, much to your chagrin, you're not going to get the corn silk, not if you like corn.
That little bit of pollen dust, it just slides right down that silk to one little specific spot and nests there and creates a kernel.
Absolutely.
Absolutely amazing. Science and life and nature.
Why
are just
I love
so
biology.
Incredible.
The miracle of life.
That's right. That's true. Let's see. Well, now, are you working on any other book right now? Since you finished the fourth law.
I'm working on my second book. It's called Incognito. It's going to be another mystery thriller.
Oh,
and
boy.
I have about 150 pages written, but I've kind of hit a little bit of a stall because I'm really trying to market the fourth law. But, you know, quite frankly, I think I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller, so I'm not going to worry about whether this other book is selling. I'm going to get right back into writing as much as I can, and that's what I really love doing. It's my passion, it's my craft. So, yeah, I'm working on the second book, Incognito.
Isn't it wonderful to be this age and to be so excited about something?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I've always been a passionate person, but this one here really brings it out of me. Yeah, I do. I love writing.
Yeah, and I think this is the best time of life. You mentioned marketing the fourth law. Before we get to Incognito, would you just please tell the listeners a little bit, because there are lots of people out there who've written books and they are trying to market their books.
Mm-hmm.
What is your secret and what's your method?
The secret, I think, what I'm learning in all the classes that I've attended is you have to have what's called a platform presence. So in other words, you need to get a website. You need to be connected on Facebook at least. You need to have all of the books, each of your books or a book available on all of the digital formats. So you can find my book on any kind of digital format that's out there, from Amazon to Nook, to e-readers, to e-book Sherpa, to anything like that. So you want to make sure that your book can be readily available and found quickly on the Internet, and that's digital marketing. I mean, that's Internet e-book marketing. So I'm available on Amazon. I've got my own website, which is www.paul-stein.com. So you got to put that dash in there. But if you go to Amazon and type in The Fourth Law by Paul Stein, it comes right up, and you go right to my website that way, too. So it's the other thing that I would stress is to do something on marketing almost every day. I mean, it's hard to do, but if it's, you know, people are talking about tweeting this, and they're talking about, you know, Facebook stuff, and I quite frankly am not as connected probably as I should be, but I do work on my website. I do try to blog as much as I can, because the more you're putting your words out there, the more the Internet is picking it up, and that's how you get exposure. So it's not an easy task, but they say it's easier now to publish a book than it's ever been because of digital formatting, because of the ability to self-publish that's how I basically did it. I went through a self-publishing process, and as long as you have a good editor and you have a good marketing people to help you create, you know, a good book cover and something that's going to be striking, well, then you're going to be well on your way. I'm still looking for a publisher, though, believe me. I would love to have an agent. I would love to have a publisher, but not yet.
Not yet. Manzanita Writers Press has been doing a lot to help authors. And we are a nonprofit, and I know that you have come with us to read from The Fourth Law at Barnes & Noble in
Love
Stockton.
Yeah. We're going to have one this Saturday, I think, aren't
that's
we?
That's right, yeah. We are. And I'm not sure when this show is going to be aired. The Barnes & Noble reading that Paul just mentioned is going to be long gone by the time the show actually gets on the air. But we always do others, and we're possibly going to do one in Sacramento eventually.
Well, I'm hoping, yeah.
And we have a date at Ironstone Vineyards on the
13th of August, yep.
And Ironstone's a lovely place in Murphy's, and that's always a nice venue to go to. So Manzanita tries to help authors with the public, with the publicity for their books and get the word out there. So that's why our listeners should go to Manza Press's website, www.manzapress.com, to find out what activities are coming up. And this, again, is in the Calaveras County area. Maybe someday we'll be back doing something in New York State. Who knows?
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Okay, well, let's hear about this book that you're working on now. I'd like to hear some of it and have you tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, well, Incognito, again, is another mystery thriller. And this one here is has a different little bit of a twist to it. It has to do, again, I like to bring in my biology and all my background with science. So this one here starts off with the Gulf oil disaster, the BP Gulf oil disaster. And there's a reporter that believes there's this conspiracy out there for eco-terrorists, basically, to create these ecological disasters, with the idea that there's somebody in the background that's taking advantage of it. They're making money off of the cleanup of all of this stuff. So this reporter has got this idea that she's come on to who it could be, and it's called The Guardian. But I'm going to read you just a couple pages of her talking to her editor, and he's questioning what she's working on, and this will kind of give you a little bit of a flavor for what's going on. So Clarence Drucker is the editor of the Washington Tribune, and this reporter's name is Stormy Field. So if you hear me talk about Stormy and Clarence, that's what it is, and I'll just read you a couple pages here. So here we go. Just then, Clarence Drucker's booming voice echoed through the cavernous old office, demanding attention. Fields, get in here, he yelled, sticking his head through the doorway of his glassed-in office that separated him from the open sea of desks throughout the warehouse. Many of the reporters and copy editors were intimidated by Drucker, but Stormy knew he was mostly bluster and rarely had the wherewithal to carry out his expletive-laced demands. The very nature of the newspaper business was stressful. The days were full of tension, driven by unrealistic deadlines that never relented. Everyone handled the stress in different ways, but it was imperative to somehow blow off the pressure or a physical illness would take hold. Drucker's method was to shout at most anything without provocation. Every day was a new day with a new deadline. It was Drucker's job to make sure everyone towed the line, meeting the circulation department's timing for laying out the presses for another copy run. If the reporters were late, it delayed the copy editors, which in turn delayed the press department, and the whole operation spiraled out of control. Eventually, trucks were sitting on the delivery dock waiting to pick up the paper for delivery to distribution stands throughout the city. The worst thing that could happen, as far as Drucker was concerned, was missing a deadline and running a story that was stale or had less than accurate information. There was always hell to pay for any of these egregious lapses in professional journalism. Stormy hustled through Drucker's office, but took enough time to avoid making it look like she was rewarding his imperious behavior. She refused to sanction his bullying. To do so would only reinforce his intolerable behavior. So that'll kind of give you a little bit of idea on where we're going with that. It's the same kind of style that I use in the other book. You can kind of pick up my voice through the dialogue there. But, yeah, Stormy and he have a very dynamic relationship. She has to kowtow to him a little bit, but she doesn't like to be bullied, so she pushes back. And it's good. She might win the Pulitzer Prize on this one, which is what her goal is. Uh-huh. So we'll see. I don't know. I haven't got that far yet. But
well, that's good. I like her name.
I can pull it together.
Stormy Fields. I like that name.
Stormy Fields. Yeah, yeah. I do pick good names. Yeah, you liked Alistair Holloway and the other.
Yes,
one. Yeah,
I did. Yeah.
I like to tinker with people's names. It's fun.
It's good. Well, Paul Stein, it has been such a pleasure having you with us today. I wish we had more time because I feel
we're
we
done already.
We're finished already. But maybe you'll come back someday.
I'd love to.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
like
love
the rambling
to.
Man that we didn't even get to talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I'm Hometown Radio. I can't remember what the new call sign is. I used to say KNGT, but I can't say that, I guess, anymore. It's KVGC.
KVGC.
The
Voice
okay.
of the Gold Country.
The Voice of the Gold Country. Right. Yeah, I was the Ramblin' Man for many years, and now I come back every other Wednesday and talk to Jim and Lucy in the morning, and we talk about Calaveras County and stuff going on over there. And it's kind of like the Ramblin' Man redo, you know?
That's right.
Yeah.
So you're no stranger to this.
Absolutely.
Well,
not.
I don't want you to be a stranger to this show either. It's been great fun, very informative, and...
And you learned about corn.
I learned about corn and corn silk, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being with
us
today.
You,
and thank you to the listeners. To the listeners in New York State and here in California, come back and see us again next week. This is Linda Field, Manzanita Voices.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.